Jeff, let's get started with the situation in Bangladesh and the importance of this country when it comes to Russia, China, and India. Who's benefiting from this coup, this type of culture in Bangladesh?
Three guesses, and the first two don't count. But first off, I would like to thank you for having me back on. I love your work. I listen to, I watch your videos. You do a wonderful job, and I'm humbled and honored to work with you today. So thank you very much. Bangladesh, in fact, I just did an article with Sputnik News asking the same question. This was clearly an American style, a color revolution. Even Hasina, Sheikh Hasina, the now deposed prime minister, who's been a lifelong politician for the Bangladeshi people, going back into the early 2000s. And so this was clearly an American push. It was a coup d'etat, and it boiled down to the United States extorting her to give the United States control of St. Martin Island. And St. Martin Island is only 3 square kilometers, but it's big enough for an airstrip and a military base. She said no, and so she had to go. And it's very similar to Hong Kong in 2019, very similar to Maidan in 2014 in Ukraine, very similar to Tiananmen in 1989 in June, you know. This is how the United States conducts diplomacy, is either with blackmail, bribery, extortion, you know, color revolutions, false flags, fake news, assassinations. And so they conducted what is called an astroturf protest, which was just like in Iran when they got rid of Mossadegh. You know, back in 1950, whatever it was, that was an astroturf. That was an astroturf protest organized out of the U.S. Embassy, you know, paying these guys to go out on the street, create havoc, kill people, destabilize the government. There's even pictures. I even have pictures and videos from Hong Kong showing people paying the protesters cash on the sidewalks to go protest. So this is how the United States works when someone wants to be independent and free of Western tyranny. So they got rid of her. They sent out the goons. It was organized. And of course, George Soros, I'm sure, has hundreds of NGOs in a country like Bangladesh. You know, they are there to overthrow governments that do not, you know, bend their knees and kiss the boots of Uncle Sam. And she left the country to save lives. That's what she said in a follow-up interview. The reason that St. Martin is so important is its geographic location. It's literally, it's actually directly across from Myanmar. I mean, it's an island at the very tip of Bangladesh in the southeast corner of Bangladesh. And right there is Myanmar. And guess what's right there in Myanmar? The Rohingya Muslims and all of that chaos that the United States is causing in Myanmar to frustrate China's port, because China built a port in the Rohingya district. The Rohingyas are Muslims, and so they're being used to, you know, to create havoc against the Myanmar government. Again, AstroTurf, you know, NGOs causing all of this. And it's right there. I mean, it's just literally, you can skip a stone from St. Martin to Myanmar. So there's one Chinese ally that's now is going to get an American air base literally spitting distance away from it. And there's Thailand is right there. Malaysia's right there. They're in ASEAN. So this is a big, big deal. Now, of course, NATO has Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, but it's way down below the equator. I mean, it's in the southern hemisphere. And so it's a long way away from the action. I mean, it's a place to keep bombers and as a logistics point. But St. Martin is just prime real estate for empire. And of course, Bangladesh and Pakistan is right there, up there with Russia, China. This was a major. From the viewpoint of Western Empire, it was a major success because Yunus, the guy that the United States practically appointed to take over for her, because once she left, the American embassy pretty much took over, and so he is a Western tool. He did some nice things with his microfinancing, but he's a Western tool, and he will definitely give the United States St. Martin sign a contract, a leasing contract, for probably some umpteen years, at least 30 years or something like that, or 50 years, and they're gonna turn St. Martin Island into Okinawa, like in Japan, which is literally an aircraft carrier in Japan for the United States. That's where most of the United States' military personnel and military bases are in Okinawa. So it's bad news for Russia. I mean, now they're going to be able to put in reconnaissance and intelligence right there. Russia and China are not very far away. India's right next door. And the United States can use now St. Martin to say, listen, we've got St. Martin now, come, be with us for the Asian Quad, what they call the Quad, with Japan, United States, Australia, and India. So yeah, Nima, it's not good news. I hate to say it, but it's not good news for the global South, and it's not good news for China. It's not good news for Russia. And it's not good news for India.
Yeah, because the government in Bangladesh had a very good relationship with India. And we know that Bangladesh is part of Belt and Road Initiative.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is all going to change. Then it seems that, do you think that at the end of the day, the main reason would be just putting some pressure on India, because they have been just talking with Russians. It seems that the United States was not successful in distancing India from Russia. That's why they're trying to do these manipulations in that region. Do you find any sort of activity that implicates they want to force India to come back into the Western agenda, what the United States is looking for in that region?
Well, it's sure that by having a major military base literally at the delta of the Bay of Bengal, I haven't gotten out of calipers to see how far St. Martin is from India. I mean, from Myanmar, it's not more than a few kilometers, but it can't be more than a couple of hundred kilometers or 300 kilometers from India. It's that close. And of course they're going to use it. There was a wonderful quote by a former UN general secretary. I've quoted it this many times. The former Egyptian, he was an Egyptian. What was his name? Anyway, in his he was a general secretary of the UN. And in his private papers after he resigned or retired or whatever, he said in his private papers, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. He said, America does not do diplomacy. America only knows how to tell other countries what to do. And he paraphrased that by saying, you know, I got into diplomacy thinking, you know, that this was a way for people to work together, even if they have differences, and they come out with a mutual decision. And he had all these high ideals when he went to university, you know, to study, you know, diplomacy and all that. But he said, Americans don't do it. He said, empires don't do diplomacy. The Romans didn't do diplomacy. You either did what the Romans told you to do, or you got destroyed. Well, that concept of empire is no different for the United States. America does not do diplomacy. America sits down and tells you what you're going to do. And if you don't, you're going to pay a price. We're going to, you know, destroy your economy. We're going to sanction you. Someone may get assassinated. There may be some military activity in your area. You know, the United States does not play nice. There's no negotiation. It's just you do what the United States says, or we're going to roll over you. So India's problem is it wants to be, you know, in both camps. You know, of course, it was a British, the British colony for 300 years, the crown jewel of the British Empire. So it's very westernized. The leaders are basically, you know, the British were replaced by, they were basically replaced by brown-skinned, anglicized, elitist leaders, you know, who don't have a lot in common with the 1.5 billion Indians, you know, on the street. So they're very anglicized, they're very westernized, other than, you know, having that good relationship with Russia after independence, with Nehru and arms, you know, buying all their military equipment, or most of the military equipment, from Russia or the Soviet Union at the time. But it's a country that just wants to be friends with Russia, wants to be friends with the United States. They're constantly they're playing the same game that the British have always played for centuries and centuries, you know, divide and conquer, you know, play one off against the other. And a lot of other countries do that, but India's big and it's important. So I can tell, you can imagine, you know, that the way the United States does business and diplomacy, you know, if India doesn't bend, the United States could very easily threaten them, you know, cause them, you know, problems, elliptical problems that are not, you know, directly, you know, but, you know, behind, you know, closed doors, et cetera. So I tell you, that little 3 square kilometer island is worth a lot to Western Empire, and they're going to use it against India. They're going to use it against China and with Burma. Well, Myanmar these days. Sorry, I'm an old guy. Used to be Burma. Now it's Myanmar. But you know, Russia, you know, is just right up there, you know, above Bangladesh and India. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare for the global South. It's a nightmare. That was a sad day to see that happen.
One of the very important political moves on the part of China when it comes to the Middle East was that they brought all these groups, Palestinian groups, together to make an agreement between these Palestinian groups. And with considering that, in your opinion, what's going on in the mind of Chinese right now when it comes to the Middle East? How do they understand what's going on, and what's their official position? Because we don't know what they're thinking of so far. It's not clear for us in the Western media because we're not talking about them a lot. In your opinion, when it comes to the Middle East and the situation right now between Iran and Israel and the situation in Gaza, how do they feel about it?
The Chinese actually believe in the United Nations Charter, just like the Russians do and the Iranians do and the North Koreans and most other countries in the world. Western Empire, NATO, you know, Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, they do not honor the United Nations Charter, which is to not interfere in the internal governance of other countries. And that's all the West does. And that's all the West has been doing for hundreds of years. So China, and of course, China was very, very much involved in the I'm having brain burps today, but the big meeting in Indonesia back in 1964 something where Zhou Enlai switched planes and lived, and because the U.S. CIA put a bomb on his plane and he switched planes and all those people died and Zhou Enlai lived. They strictly believe in this. You know, they really, really believe in this. That's why so many countries enjoy working with China, because you're not going to get the color revolution, you know, package if you work with China. If you work with anybody from the West, you know, France, Germany, England, even Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you are immediately in danger of color revolution machinations. China does not do that. They really, really adhere to that, and that people like that. So they're not going to get involved in the Middle East like the United States does. They're not going to, you know, go in and tell them what to do. They're trying to do classic, you know, 20th century diplomacy, where they're trying to bring people together. They're trying to create conversation. They're trying to create consensus. They're trying to come up with some ideas, you know, to resolve this problem. They've come out with their peace plan that everybody loved except Zelensky. And of course, the United States didn't like it and NATO didn't like it. So this is how China works. I mean, they're constantly talking, they're constantly in airplanes, they're constantly, you know, going to countries. In fact, I just saw Wang Yi, the foreign minister, was in Thailand today, and they're talking about, you know, more cooperation there. The Chinese, you know, they realize that every country in the Middle East, except Iran, is occupied by the U.S. military. Maybe not. I don't know about Lebanon, but I don't know if there's any American soldiers in Lebanon. But everywhere else, there are thousands of American soldiers and materiel in the Gulf. Monarchies, you know, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Turkey, of course, is NATO. So I think they realize their limits. I mean, they're not going to go up against the United States in a way that's going to be confrontational in the Middle East. They're going to just keep plugging away. You know, diplomats are some of the most patient, indulgent people in the world. You know, when something doesn't work, they just keep trying this angle. And if that angle doesn't work, they try this angle. And if it doesn't work, then let's go talk to these people. And they're diplomats are amazing people. So they're just looking for solutions to an intractable situation. And it's also good soft power. I mean, let's face it, they have an image to keep overseas. The Chinese are just like everybody else. They want to look good. in front of John Q. Public in the Middle East and in Europe and in North America and Africa and everywhere else. So that's not the major reason they're doing this, but it's for them. It's the benefit of looking diplomatic, holistically at the situation. And it's also good for the image of the government back home, because the Chinese government can say, look at what we're trying to do, while the United States and Israel are killing tens of thousands of people in Palestine. Look what we're doing. So they can convey to their own people that they are doing what the United Nations Charter is all about. Oh yeah, the Bandung Conference in Indonesia. I think it was 1966, something like that. Anyway, and that's where the non-aligned movement got started. You know, the 77 countries and China's included. That's where the non-aligned movement got started, was to stay away from the Soviet Union, stay away from China, or stay away from the United States, and try to be independent. So that's what they're doing, and they're going to keep, they're going to keep looking, for solutions. They're going to keep trying to get people to hold hands. They're going to, just like they got Saudi Arabia and Iran to work together and reestablish diplomatic relations. And now they're both, in BRICS. And has Saudi Arabia joined SCO? I'm not sure, but Iran has joined SCO, the Shanghai Security Cooperation Organization. So that's all. They're just doing what diplomats do best, and that is talk, create dialogue, and that dialogue try to find solutions, as improbable as it probably is.
You talk about diplomats, and if we assume that the main duty of a diplomat would be making compromise and cooperation through talks and negotiations, do we have any diplomats left in Washington, in your opinion? Or we have Bill Burns right now talking in negotiations in Qatar, and Bill Burns is a diplomat, but he's not in his place. He's head of the director of CIA, but why he couldn't be the Secretary of State of the United States? That would be much better for the United States. But beyond that, do you see, because he's not working, he shows with the conflict in Ukraine and right now in the Middle East, we don't see any sort of diplomatic attitude in Washington.
I'll be honest with you, Nima. I think after World War II, the Americans probably from 1945 until 1990, with competition with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, that long Cold War period, they probably did more cooperation and more consensus than now. But once the Soviet Union was out of the picture, and they felt like that it was the end of history, and that capitalism, Western capitalism, which America was the, which America is the, is the, you know, the shining beacon of global capitalism. I think at that point, they switched to global cop mode, and became very, very ugly. This is what I was talking about, where the former Secretary General of the UN, the Egyptian, was saying they don't do diplomacy. They just don't do diplomacy. And also, when China sends diplomats, they're looking for win-win cooperation. the diplomats, and you can throw in Europe. I mean, look at Joseph Borrell, you know, the foreign secretary of the European Union. I mean, he's arrogant, he's hubristic. He says insulting racist things to people who he's trying to work with. That's the same thing that the United States does, you know, with the people it works with. So it's not just the United States, it's this Western Empire, you know, mentality. And so I don't think especially since 1990, you know, with the fall of the U.S., I don't think there are any diplomats. And there certainly aren't any right now. I mean, I'm having terrible brain burps today, Nima. I'm sorry. We're taking care of our two grandkids. So we got grandkids. And so I'm dead. The former Secretary of State for Trump,
Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo, you know, he said, you know, when we were in the CIA, we lied, we cheated, you know. He's all, they're proud of it. You know, they're proud of this. They're proud of their arrogance. They're proud of what they can get away with. And look what they're getting away with in Palestine. Look what they're getting away with in Syria. Look what they're getting away with in Libya. Look what they're getting, you know, it's just, it goes on and on and on. And so no, there's no diplomats. There's just you know, enforcers, you know, like the mafia. You know, they come in. It reminds me of that story. The guy that wrote the book, I was a prostitute for the CIA, the German journalist. You know, and he said, you know, if they can't flatter you, if they can't buy you off, and then you know what they do is two guys with black suits and black ties show up with briefcases, and that's when the extortion comes in. You know, you want your wife to live? Here's pictures of your children leaving school. Are you worried about them? That's how the United States works. That's how the West works. And so that they're not diplomats. They're gangsters, basically. And I mean, I'm sure there's probably some idealistic guys, you know, in some of the smaller countries and some of the smaller, you know, less important, you know, countries in the world. But, you know, the big, you know, Russia, China, you know, India, Europe, you know, North America, you know, the big important countries that they're trying to control. I'm sure I don't think there's any diplomats, just thugs.
The other thing that just recently last week, I think this week, we've learned that the United States, just the Biden administration said, we are going to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. We are going to change our policy toward Saudi Arabia by selling weapons to them. In your opinion, what are the main objectives of changing the policy? And do they really think that would benefit their position in Saudi Arabia by doing this?
First off, I want to go back. The former, I just looked it up while you were asking the question, the former UN Secretary General, the Egyptian who wrote that about how the United States does not do, it was Boutros-Ghali. Well, the United States, you know, is just seeing that they're losing Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia, you know, made that wonderful agreement with Nixon back in 1972-73, you know, we will only accept U.S. dollars for our oil, which at the time was the biggest oil producer in the world. It had a huge presence. Of course, now there's Iran and Venezuela and Nigeria and Russia, who've really come online. And so Saudi Arabia's not as important as it used to be. But back then, Saudi Arabia signed a pact with the devil to be protected, you know, by the U.S. military, which doesn't speak well for the leadership there, that they don't have enough trust in their people to, you know, to that they have to have U.S. military in their, you know, on their territory, you know, to protect the monarchy. But, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, got BRICS, and Saudi Arabia is looking at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and Saudi Arabia loves the Belt and Road Initiative, and Saudi Arabia has its own 2030. That's this wonderful visionary Chinese-esque development program for the country. Who's getting most of the contracts to build all of that infrastructure? China. And so Saudi Arabia has broken the rule that they will only sell their oil in dollars, and now they're accepting Chinese, you know, yuan. They're accepting other currencies. They're doing cross border currency exchanges with their customers. So I don't think that this was a case where the United States had to eat a little bit of crow, humble crow, and try to get Saudi Arabia back into its orbit. But I think it's too late. I think MSB or is it MBS Mohammed bin Salman? Yeah, MBS Mohammed bin Salman. I think he's kind of sick of the United States. I think he's just fed up. I know he treated Biden. He's treated Biden and Blinken extremely coldly, really, really almost insulting them. I know in one case, I think it was when Biden visited him, where they sit at a coffee table, you know, and they've got the two flags. There was no American flag. There was only the Saudi flag. They didn't even put the American flag out. So I think Mohammed bin Salman, I think he's just a bit fed up. And if the United States wants to sell them some more arms, you know, why not, you know? But I don't think it's going to do anything to change Saudi Arabia's baptism in global cooperation with China, with Russia. I mean, you know, look at, you know, now MBS and Putin call each other, you know, I mean, yeah, she's been there, you know, Xi Jinping, the president's been there. I think Saudi Arabia will continue to drift away from the American orbit, but you're never a free country if you're militarily occupied. And Saudi Arabia has got several thousand, you know, U.S. troops there. And that's, you know, something that they'll have to deal with later down the road if they want to try to do that. But I think with the instability in the region, you know, it's a counterweight against Iran. You know, I mean, they're working together, but still, you know, they're not kissing each other. They're shaking hands. They're not kissing each other. So there's still some, you know, some reluctance, you know, to totally embrace, you know, Iran. And And then you've got, you know, the nightmare in Syria and Iraq. So I think they'll probably, you know, not ask the U.S. military to leave, like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have done in Africa, asking all the NATO troops to leave their countries. And they got them out. But I don't think the Saudi Arabia will do that for any time soon.
And in the conflict in the Middle East, we had Shoigu going to Iran and the head of CENTCOM went to Israel. At the same time, we had Shoigu in Iran. How close are the relationships between Iran and Russia right now? Are they getting to a... We know that they're going to sign a military agreement between these countries, but how about having a security agreement? Do you think they're getting to that point?
Well, they are already members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So it's semi, you know, the Shanghai Cooperation is officially is officially military slash economic. So they already are, you know, at least, you know, honor bound to help each other in the SCO. I think the big thing that Russia and Iran need to do is to get one of these 25-year comprehensive agreements signed. I think the last I heard they were working on it, unless you've heard something differently, you know, like what China has done with Iran, you know, this big 25-year multifaceted agreement for infrastructure, you know, everything, telecommunications, oil, gas, you know, ports, military. I mean, that's what they need to do. And I know last year they were sitting down and saying, we really got to get this hammered out. And I don't know how close they are now. And of course, now with Iran having a new president unexpectedly, that sure doesn't help. I recall Putin called the new Iranian president and congratulated him. They now have this north-south corridor, you know, the rail and ship corridor, you know, from Russia to Iran. I think they're working a lot closer together than people realize. The Russians are very, they don't brag, you know, they're very subdued. You know, they don't come out in a lot of fanfare. We're doing this and we're doing that. And they're very understated in their diplomacy and cooperation with other countries. And whereas, you know, China kind of gets all the flash with the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative. I think Iran and Russia are working probably a lot more closely than people realize. And I don't know if it's true or not, but there was the story that after Iran, not this last assassination, but when Iran bombed Israel, what was it, sometime last year, and hit them pretty hard. You know, they have their hypersonic missiles that the Israelis cannot touch. And the rumor was is that Israel sent an F-35 with a small nuclear bomb to fly over Tehran and drop it, not to really kill anybody, but to create a massive electromagnetic, you know, burnout, so to burn out all their telecommunications and all of their electricity. And the rumor was that Russia shot that plane down. So I don't know. Pepe Escobar brought it up and he asked like two or three guys and they said it was true. So if Russia did that for Iran, that means they're pretty tight. There's no proof that it happened, but as soon as it left, I think it was, it left Jordanian territory or something, they shot it down between Jordan and I think they're doing fine. They're also talking about, you know, trying to come up with this, you know, money exchange, you know, with the BRICS, you know, coming up with it, with the special drawing rights. They're not kissing on screen, but I think they're taking care of business.
Yeah. And with the situation, when it comes to the situation right now in Ukraine and this Ukrainian attack on Kursk region, do you think that Russia is losing its patience toward NATO and the way that NATO is operating, helping Ukrainians do whatever they want in that region?
Oh my God, Nima! I heard you had on Dmitry Orlov this week, and he was saying, "Well, you know, they're just waiting for the U.S. empire to collapse." Well, I'm frustrated. You're frustrated. Everybody's frustrated. You know that Russia just seems like they have until the 22nd century for this thing to end. They and this this. horrible thing happens. They blow up a dam, and then they attack the nuclear, the big nuclear power center, and there's all this bluster that this is the last time, and this is the last time, and now they're in Russian territory, and they're saying this is the last time. Although this time Putin actually said it, and it wasn't just Medvedev, you know, the former prime minister, who said it. But I think we waiting a long time for the U.S. empire to collapse. I mean, the British Empire really collapsed in 1904, 1905 after the Boer War, the Boer Wars in South Africa. They were bankrupt, and they were literally bankrupt. And the only thing that kept them going is they got the gold and diamond mines in South Africa. Then they meticulously planned World War One. To keep the ball going and take out Germany, which they did. And then they, you know, they connived, you know, to get Hitler into power so that they could try to get Russia's resources. And that didn't work. And America ended up being the hand of the batons. So it takes decades for an empire to collapse. So I wouldn't hold my breath that the U.S. empire is going to collapse anytime soon, but because they own the media, they can print, they can still be printing money left and right. I don't know what to tell you, Nima. I kind of lost my train of thought. What was your question?
The question was the reaction coming from Russia in order to respond to NATO.
It drives me nuts. It's like they're taking little villages by little villages, and it's just like one insult after another, and they're sending drones northeast of Moscow, you know, and they're killing people deep inside Russia, and now their ground forces are in Kursk, and it's just like, when are you all going to do something about this? Of course, we all know that if Russia wanted to, it could do what the United States does and has been doing since World War II against Germany and Japan. They we saw it in Iraq, you know, and with the supposed Iraq wars, you know, where they just flattened the country and no regard for civilian life, no regard for infrastructure, no regard for anything. And so it is true. Russia is trying to avoid civilian losses. And they are, you know, bleeding NATO dry. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, if it would be interesting to see what Russia could do, you know, if they just picked up the pace a little in Ukraine, because right now Europe and the United States are in no position to try to ramp up their weapon production. I mean, they're just way behind Russia and China. So, you know, you're just like me. It's just like, when are you all going to start kicking some butt? You know, when are you all going to start, you know, rolling, you know, not village by village. When are you going to like roll into Kiev? You know, it's just like, why don't you start blowing up, you know, the headquarters, you know, the Rada and Kiev, and start, you know, creating some chaos. I'm just as frustrated as you. And the only guy that's talking about it is Medvedev, you know, the former president and you know, he's the black hat, you know, he gets on Twitter and he gets on Telegram, and he says, we're going to take it to them, we're going to kill them, but it never happens. So I think we as Westerners do not understand the way Russians think. When you have a country that's been invaded about every 50 years for the last 1,000 years, you know, that's a quote that, you know, Putin said, we get invaded every 50 years because people want our resources. So I think they just have a completely different outlook to how to how to conduct a war like this. And that's all I can tell you, or that maybe they know some things that we don't about, you know, I think what, instead of waiting for the U.S., for the U.S. empire to collapse, which could be well into, which could go on for another decade or two, let's be honest. But I think they're just, I think they're just waiting for the Ukrainian manpower to just be depleted. And apparently that's, you know, they're now taking 50, 60 year old men. They're, you know, chasing, you know, retirees down, you know, on the street, you know, send them to the front. They're sending young women. They lowered the recruitment age, I think, down to 25, and I'm sure it'll be down to 18 eventually. And who knows, there may even be child soldiers, you know, fighting for Ukraine. So that's all I can tell you. I look at the map every day. It doesn't change. And I'm just like, oh, God. So.
Thank you, Jeff, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.